So I want to welcome those of you who are watching from literally more and more all over the world. It is quite remarkable. And the thing that's so exciting to me about that is this growing number of men and women who put their faith in Jesus, who realize it's not enough to call ourselves Christians, but we want to be followers of Jesus and followers of the King, that who've come to realize that it's doing is what makes the difference. And when Jesus said, hey, he who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The growing number of people all over the world who realize it really is about following Jesus. It's about doing what Jesus asks us to do. That's what makes the difference in our homes. That's what makes the difference in our communities. Ultimately, that's what makes the difference in the world. And ultimately, it's what made a huge difference in the world following the resurrection of Jesus. So if you're a part of that growing number, congratulations. It's so exciting to worship with you and have an opportunity to say a few words to you today as we wrap up our very, I call it our very Merry Christmas series. Isn't this like the most merriest Christmas series you've ever been a part of? No, it hasn't. Our Christmas series is entitled Sinners Like Me. And I want to jump in today with something we all have in common. This isn't like a religious thing, a Christian thing. This is just a people thing. Something that we're all really good at. And the reason we're so good at it is we started practicing in middle school and then in high school. And as adults, we have perfected it. And the official, you know, title for this thing that we do, we'll just call it image management, where we showcase our strengths and we camouflage our not so strengths. Image management is about selling a version of ourselves, the best version of ourselves, while at the same time hiding part of ourselves. And this is not bad. This isn't a criticism. I'm not being critical. I mean, come on. You don't really want to know everything about me. You just want to have sort of a, you know, Andy's a good guy kind of vision of me. And honestly, I'll return the favor. I don't want to know everything about you. I mean, you seem like wonderful, pleasant people. Let's just kind of keep it that way. This is one reason that marriage is so good for us, because at least one person knows everything. And if one person knows everything, that's enough. That's all the people I need to know everything about me to help me become the best version of me and hopefully the best version of you. So image management is natural, and it's advisable. It's advisable to bring our A game, right? To bring our A game when we're having to sell ourselves, that first date, your A game, right? That first job interview for that company you really want to work with, you brought your best game. Meet the parents, A game. You know, meet the neighbors. You know, meet your future boss. But, and again, you know this, you're smart, emotionally mature people. Once the relationship is sort of established, then once there's some trust that's established, then it's appropriate that you begin to open up, right? And you begin to tell the rest of your story. It reminds me of all of our small groups. Sandra and I have been in community groups, small groups, since before the church began 30 years ago. And whenever you're in a small group, there's an opportunity for people to share their stories. That's how you get to know each other. And maybe you've had this experience. So you get together, you know, maybe some of the couples or maybe some of the people in your group, if you're in a men's group or women's group. So the first person tells their story, very G-rated, okay? Second person, PG-13. Third person or third couple, PG-13. Fourth couple, little R in there, you know? And then by the time everybody's finished, the first couple's like, we need to go again because we skipped over some stuff. We didn't know that we were going to go this deep, this fast. And suddenly, but the point is, there's a point where you begin to tell the less than stellar decisions you've made, some of those embarrassing moments, but there's a natural order to things, right? And if you get things out of order, there is no second date. You get things out of order, there is no second job interview. Get things out of order, you know, your new neighbors build a higher fence or they decide they don't want to have anything to do with your family. So we all get that. Well, the reason I bring that up is apparently, nobody told Matthew about any of that. Matthew, who wrote the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, who brings us an account of the life of Jesus. And I say that because when making his case for the identity of Jesus, he does it all wrong. He goes about it backwards. He doesn't begin with the precious birth narratives, you know, about Mary and Joseph, and they make their way and they find a manger and there's a star. He goes about it all backwards. He doesn't begin with the birth narratives. He actually begins, as we've seen in this series, with a genealogy, a list of Jesus' ancestors, kind of a linear family tree where he goes a father who had a son, who had a son, who had a son, who had a son. And as we've seen, he goes unnecessarily out of his way to air the dirty laundry of all of Jesus' ancestors, which hurts rather than helps his case. And when I say his case, here's what I mean by that. And this is so important if you've just started reading the Bible or you're new to faith. Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew isn't just telling a story about Jesus. The point of Matthew isn't, there was a man named Jesus, here's some things he did, here's some things he said. That's not his point. Matthew is actually making a case. Matthew is actually building a case for the identity of Jesus. And he doesn't bury the lead. It's his opening line in his gospel, in this document that the documents the life and teaching and the works of Jesus. And the reason we miss this is because if you start reading the book of Matthew, it's like begat, 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 or the father of father of father of father of, and we miss his thesis. And his thesis is chapter 1, verse 1. This is how he opens his account of the life of Jesus. He says it this way: this is the genealogy, not just of Jesus. That wouldn't even be interesting. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. The Hebrew word Messiah refers to an anointed one, as in somebody who's been anointed king. The Greek version of this word is Christ. Just, you know, so you know, Christ is not Jesus' last name. Okay, Christ is a title. It means anointed one. So this could be the, you know, Jesus the king, God's final king. Now, for ancient Jews, this is a big deal. For ancient Jews, if Matthew's gonna make the case that Jesus is God's final king, then he's also gotta make the case that, Jesus was related to Israel's greatest king. So Matthew says, he's right up front, he says, this is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David. David, Israel's most famous king, they would, some would argue, Israel's greatest king. And of course, Jesus wasn't David's son. There's 14 generations between David and Jesus, but this is the way they spoke. So this is a flyover about 14 generations. So to set this up for where we're going today, I got to give you a little backstory about David. And just so you know, if you're new to Bible study, this is David, like David and Goliath, King David. So David lived about 1,000 BC, so about 1,000 years before Jesus. He was Israel's second king, and he was a warrior king. David, he came onto the scenes as the giant killer, and he just went from there and became the mighty warrior. He becomes king. He settles all the regional disputes between Israel and the surrounding nations or territories. He settles the borders. He sets up commerce and trade, and he brings peace to the land. And as he gets older and he's got all that done, he decides, you know what? Our God, Yahweh, that was the Jewish God, is the Jewish God. Yahweh needs a temple, needs a building of his own. All these pagan, you know, religions around us, they all have temples to their gods. Our God doesn't have a temple. So David decides, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna build our God a temple. So he starts making plans to build God a temple. And God sends a prophet named Nathan, and Nathan shows up and says, okay, I got a word from the Lord. He doesn't want a temple. He doesn't need a temple. And by the way, you can't build it anyway because you have too much blood on your hands. If there's gonna be a temple, you know, your son can build the temple. Now, I don't have time to talk a lot about this, but there's so much in this story because essentially God kind of through the prophet warns, if you try to put me in a box, there's going to be trouble. And the problem with a temple is a temple would begin to represent the presence of God. And if God is over there in his little house, then I can go over here and do whatever I want to. And whenever we try to put God in a box, we are in trouble. In fact, just real quick, if you left Christianity, if you left the church years ago, here's my hunch, and we've never met, I don't know your story. You were presented a version of Christianity that was like a box, and God was in the box. And when that quit working for you, or when you saw through that, or you saw the problems with that, or you saw the hypocrisy of all the people in the box with God, you were out. And you felt like you had no choice but to turn your back on your faith, Christianity, the church, and perhaps God. And I just want you to know, anybody that puts God in a box, they have set you up for trouble. And the good news is, God doesn't live in a box. God doesn't live in a box. His circle of grace and mercy is so big, as we're about to see, that it is astounding. Anyway, back to the story. So the prophet Nathan says, David, God says you can't build a temple. If there's gonna be one, even though he doesn't need one, doesn't necessarily want one, your son can build the temple. But God has a message for you, David. And so here is what God said to David through the prophet Nathan. Again, about 1,000 years before Jesus. Here's what he said. I will make your name great, David. I'm gonna make your name so great, it's gonna be like the names of the greatest men on earth. This is 3,000 years ago. So quick survey, and I want, with a show of hands, okay, I want everybody to play along. If you're watching, wherever you are, show of hands, whatever campus you're in. If you're driving, keep one hand on the wheel, okay? How many of you, this is very important for the sermon, how many of you had already heard of King David before you got here today? Look at that. Just like the prophet said to David, your name is going to be like the greatest men who have ever lived 3,000 years later. Even if you don't believe any of this is true, you'd heard of King David. I'd say put a check in that box. That's amazing. Okay, that was just for fun. Anyway, then the prophet goes on and he says, and David, here's what God promises you. Your house or your family and your kingdom, because you're the king, is going to endure forever, long after you're gone. And your throne that represents your power and influence will be established forever. I mean, what a promise. So as time went by, there was no longer a Davidic ancestor on the throne in Israel. In fact, by the time, this is important, by the time Jesus came along, there had not been a Davidic ancestor on the throne for hundreds and hundreds of years. So much time had gone by that most Jewish people thought this isn't even a reality. The priest and the Pharisees, specifically the priest, they didn't want there to be a Davidic king on the throne, so they weren't looking for one, they weren't expecting one. But there was a remnant of people who took this promise to mean that eventually God would send his final king. That final king, that final anointed one, that Messiah would be in the line of David. And so it was so important to Matthew to prove to the people he's making this case to, this is Jesus is God's final king, and he meets the criteria because he is actually related to King David. That's why he gives us, and that's why he goes into this detailed, meticulous genealogy. Because later, it was understood that God is going to show up and do something. In fact, remember this, when Jesus came along, Israel had a king, King Herod. Herod wasn't even Jewish, okay? He wasn't even close. So people had given up. And now Matthew is saying, hey, you're not gonna believe this. It's happened. Just as God promised David, a descendant of David has come and he is God's Messiah. He is God's final king. Okay, so back to Matthew. So after stating his thesis, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, he backs up and then he works through all of Jesus' ancestors. This is kind of the boring part. Unless you've been a part of this series, it ain't boring and it's about to get even less boring today, so hang on. So he works his way through all these people. Tamar and Judah, that was week one. Highlights all these embarrassing people. Tamar was the daughter-in-law who tricked her father-in-law into having a baby with her, and the baby is Perez, and the baby Perez is actually in the line of Jesus, who's the Messiah. Then there was Rahab. Last week, we talked about Rahab, the Canaanite. She wasn't even an Israelite, and she's in the lineage of Jesus, even though she had a child with an Israelite of mixed race. So picking up where we left off last week, and again, we don't get far before we bump into a woman in a list of 40 men. Here's what the text says. Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, we talked about Rahab last week. Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was, and now we have another mother in a list of fathers. 40 fathers, just, three or four women. And as we said throughout this series, when Matthew introduces a woman's name into this male genealogy, it's because he wants us to stop and pause and remember the story connected with that particular woman, to draw attention to her. And the reason he wants to draw our attention to Ruth is not the beautiful story that maybe you heard in Sunday school or you've heard in church of how Ruth meets Boaz and they fall in love and Boaz is the protector and he saves her from poverty and it's just a beautiful love story. Matthew's like, that's not a story I'm interested in. That's not it. That's wonderful. That's not why I drew your attention to Ruth. Here's why I drew our attention to Ruth. Because like Rahab, Ruth is not an Israelite. Ruth was a Moabite. Now, this is really crazy. And they did not teach us this in Sunday school. So buckle up for just a minute. Ruth is a Moabite. The Moabites were a tribe of people or a small nation that lived in what we would consider modern day Jordan right now. And the Moabites were descendants of an incestuous relationship between Abraham's nephew and one of his daughters. Do you know this story? No, you don't. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you this story. And here's why I'm gonna tell you this story, even though it's kinda Because Matthew wants us to go, ugh, wow, yeah, I didn't see that coming. So here's the story. Lot, Abraham's nephew, lived in Sodom. You know, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So Sodom and Gomorrah is burning. There's sulfur everywhere, and the world's coming to an end. In fact, everywhere they looked, it looked like their entire world had come to an end. So he has escaped. He has escaped with his daughters, and they go to a little town. They can't stay there. The whole world's coming apart. So he and his daughters, Lot and his two daughters, go live in a cave up in the mountains. And time goes by, and they're realizing, okay, we're going to spend the rest of our life in this cave with our father. We're never going to have a husband. In fact, from their vantage point, this is not in the text, but when you read the story, from their vantage point, it really looked like they might be the only people left on planet Earth, and there weren't going to be any options for them to have husbands. So anyway, these two young ladies wanted children, which is understandable because a woman without a child in those days was so dangerous. You needed children for security, especially a son. So the two girls get daddy drunk two nights in a row. Here's a verse no one's memorized and put on their mirror. Thus, both of the daughters of Lot were with children by their father. Let's just get rid of that screen. That's just, it's like, what? The firstborn of his daughters bore a son, and she called him Moab. And he is the father of the Moabites to this day. Ruth, the Moabite. I know, you would have been fine going the rest of your life without knowing that story. I know. Matthew draws our attention to it. Why? He draws our attention. I mean, come on. Technically, ethically, morally, even by ancient standards, Ruth should have never been born. And maybe this is Matthew's point. I don't know. Have you ever been told that someone would be better off if you had never been born? Have you ever been told you shouldn't have been born? Has someone ever implied that you were an accident? Have you ever felt like your family would be better off if you'd never been born? That maybe the world would be better off if you'd never been born? Here's the good news of great joy for all the people at Christmas. You, God, is not embarrassed by you. He ensured that you were represented in the lineage of your king. And not once, and not twice, but as we're about to discover today, three times. You are not an accident. You are an image bearer. And Matthew wants you to know that before he unfolds the story of Jesus, your king. Whew. Moving on. Back to the boring part for a second. Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of, and then really quick, we bump into the only name in the whole list that has a title, a name with fame. Jesse was the father of King David. And there he is, arguably the most important person on this list. Arguably the most important person on this list. And surely, come on, Matthew, surely you're not going to do anything to draw negative attention to King David, right? I mean, the whole point of your gospel, the whole point of your document is to make the case that Jesus is God's final king, and which means he is related to David, and his relationship to David is of paramount, you know, importance, right? I mean, this is why he includes the title, so we don't confuse this David with another David. This is King David. So surely Matthew isn't going to go there, but he does. And listen to how he does it. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David, and David was the father of Solomon, whose mother, and it's like, okay, you are going to go there. And some of you know this story and some of you don't. And some of you are going to be glad you came to church today because, or listen today, because this is maybe the story you've only heard bits and pieces of. And Matthew doesn't want us to skip the story, but listen, he's writing this out, or maybe he's dictating this. He's probably dictating it. He was wealthy, had scribes that did all this for him. He pauses, and he knows that everyone reading this document, all of his Jewish readers in the first century, he knows that they know this story. They already know the story. And most of us already know the story. So it's like, okay, Matthew, if you have to go there, just say her name, just like you did with Tamar, just like you did with Rahab, just like you did with Ruth, just say her name. And Matthew's like, no, I don't want to just say her name because you might skip by it. I want you to feel the weight of this incident that produced a baby that was in the lineage of Jesus, your king. It's like he wants to rub our noses in this story. Like, don't forget. Don't you dare attempt to sanitize this. Don't you dare attempt to glamorize this or somehow, you know, remove the gritty, earthy family history of your king. So listen to how he states this. It is like right in our face. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Twist the knife. Solomon's mother was another man's wife until King David abused his power and sees Uriah's wife one night and says to a servant, get her for me. Your Highness, that is the wife of Uriah. It doesn't matter whose wife she is. Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, was also the daughter of one of David's best friends, a man that had risked his life to protect David. This is who this woman is. You get her for me. And the servant had no choice. And perhaps Bathsheba had no choice. And they spend the night together. They probably spent several nights together. And then he gets a message, I'm pregnant. Meanwhile, his mighty men that he should have been with are out bleeding out and in the muddy battlefield trying to conquer a walled city. And you know, perhaps you know this story. So David decides, and listen, and men, I want you to listen to this part. David decides, I can handle outcomes. I can handle outcomes. I can manage outcomes. And he tries to manage the outcome and he makes it worse. And he takes a bad story and adds another bad chapter and another bad chapter and another bad chapter. And ladies and gentlemen, but men in particular, when we try to manage the outcome of our bad decisions, we just add bad chapters to bad stories. And David should have known better. And because he should have known better and because we know this story, you should know better and I should know better. But David's gonna handle the outcome. He's the king, come on. So he invites, you remember the story? He invites Uriah off the battlefield. Hey, Uriah, how's it going out there? It's going pretty good. Hey, while you're here, spend the night in town. And listen, why don't you go home and, you know, be with your wife tonight? David gets up the next morning, finds out Uriah slept outside the palace gates with the servants on the ground, the ones that would sleep there to protect the king. And David's like, what are you doing here? I sent you home. And righteous, valiant, you know, warrior leader Uriah's like, how could I comfort myself with my wife when my men are bleeding out in the mud outside the walls of the city we're trying to take? I couldn't do that. He's such a great man. And David's like, hey, I need you to stay one more night. That night they party. He gets Uriah drunk. He points him toward home and says, go home. Wakes up the next day and Uriah has once again slept on the ground on his mat outside the palace gates. Because how could I go comfort myself with my wife when my men are bleeding out in the mud in the field? And then King David writes a note to Joab, the commander in the field. Put Uriah in the front, close to the walls. And when the battle is the hottest, withdraw from him. This was a death sentence. He writes it, he signs it, he seals it, and he gives it to Uriah to deliver to Joab. And see, this is when God interrupts and says, okay, hey, David, remember that thing about your kingdom will endure forever, you're gonna have the throne forever? We're canceling that. You're out. You're not my guy. So to cover his adultery, David arranges for Uriah to be killed in battle. Bathsheba mourns, she's pregnant. And then David marries her. And by the way, in a slave culture, there are no secrets. Everybody knows. David marries Bathsheba. She has a son, and the baby dies. She mourns. She gets pregnant again with David. And the text tells us she gave birth to a son, so they named him Solomon. Now, a little more backstory, because you seem interested. David had 7 or 8 wives. It's hard to count. He had 7 or 8 wives. David had 19 sons. Again, hard to count, but 19 sons that survived into adulthood. He had more than that. 19 sons. 19 options for who would follow him as the king of Israel. 19 options. Which son of 19 sons would you have not chosen? La-di-da, di-da. La-di-da-da-dee-dee. Your Savior came from a long line of sinners. Most of us would argue worse than you and worse than me. God chose Solomon, who should have never been born in the first place. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Never even says her name. Forces us into the story. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was the father of, we're like, okay, we got it, Matthew. We get it. We get it. We get it. Can we please just jump ahead to, there were shepherds abiding in their fields, watching over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord shone round about them. They were sore afraid. And the angel said, do not be afraid, I bring. Can we just get to the Christmas story? Matthew, you are ruining the Christmas story. I think Matthew would say, I'm not ruining it. I'm including you in it. And besides, he would say, this isn't a story. This is history. Come on. This is God wading into the chaos that humanity created. This is God wading into the chaos of sin. The chaos of sin where we hurt ourselves and we hurt the people around us, and then we're hurt by other people, and so we hurt other people. This is God wading into the chaos of human history to do something in the world, to do something for the world, to do something in spite of the world. And Matthew would tell us, I believe, and he would say, look, and if you will read the rest of this document, if you will follow me as I follow Jesus through his life, God will do something in you, for you, in spite of you. Matthew reminds us that God was so, this is amazing, that God was so committed to his agenda that he kept his promise to and through, ready for this? To and through Abraham the dishonest. Take my wife Sarah, she's really just my sister, we're kind of cousins. Hey, take her, Pharaoh. Like, what? That's Abraham. Through Tamar the desperate, Judah the promise breaker, slave trader who sold his own brother into slavery. Through Rahab the Canaanite, Ruth the Moabite. Through David, this, we didn't even get to these stories, the village raising, power abusing, murdering, adulterer. None of these stories are pretty. They're better than pretty. They're epic. For our sake, Matthew refuses to look the other way, and he refuses to allow us to look the other way. He refuses to allow us to sand off the rough edges, to sanitize and pretend. For your sake, for my sake, he highlights the misfits and the embarrassments, because that's who our king came from, but more importantly, that's who our king came for sinners like me. Jesus was nothing like us, but he came for us, and he came in spite of us. He wasn't embarrassed to be associated with us. And this is, I think, where Matthew maybe just puts his pen down or sends everybody out of the room and just thinks about that moment. He wasn't embarrassed by us. Jesus asked me to follow him. And where did we go? Matthew would say, in fact, he records it for us. He wanted me to follow him, and we went to my house. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting at my table surrounded by people who were sinners just like me. And there's the rabbi from Nazareth sitting at my table. And outside my property, you know, my property boundary, and he had pretty good property, stands all the religious people, all the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But the rabbi is in the circle in my house with me. It was like he was not afraid to associate with a sinner like me. And this is the message Matthew wants you to know and wants me to know. This is the gospel he's about to roll out for us. And he wants to make sure at the very outset, we know that we are not excluded, that we are included, that the circle of God's grace and the circle of God's mercy knows no boundary. And the people that Jesus was most frustrated with were people like I used to be, who stood on the outside looking in, asking the question, how can you be with people like them instead of the self-righteous people like me? So let's be honest for a minute, okay? And you don't have to be a religious person. You may be of a different faith variety, or you may, you don't know. But just for a minute, let's all be honest. At some level, in some season of your life, maybe in this current season, or if not some season of your life or your current season, maybe at least in the dark recesses of your thoughts, when your thoughts go astray and top over the boundaries and go where they shouldn't go, isn't it true that you would find all of us on Matthew's list? Because we've lied and we've cheated and we've been unfaithful and we've been disloyal and we've hurt people. We've murdered people's reputation with our words. We've murdered people's self-esteem with our criticism. We've murdered people's careers in some cases because the ideas we took as our own and the ideas that we didn't share. Isn't it true that we've broken promises? And perhaps as you consider your sin, and perhaps as you consider where you would be on the list and who you would identify with, perhaps you would think what Matthew thought, that maybe you've fallen too far. Matthew would assure you, oh, no. Yeah, we're just getting started. Matthew would say, I know exactly what that feels like. I was a traitor, he would tell you. I was a thief. Matthew would say, look, I impoverished my own people as a tool of the Roman Empire. There was no one lower than me. And then one day I looked up into the eyes of compassion and everything changed. And the rabbi from Galilee invited me to follow him. And I've never gotten over the fact that he would invite a sinner like me. And there was no question in his mind what kind of person I was. I was doing the thing. I was doing the very thing that put me outside the realm of temple worship, outside the realm of my family inviting me anywhere, outside of the realm of friendship with other Jewish righteous people. I was doing the thing that set me apart. And he looked at me and he said, I want you to follow me. And Matthew would say, I've never gotten over it. And now here I am. A former tax collector and traitor. And I'm documenting the life, not of Jesus, the rabbi teacher, Jesus, the king. Which kind of begs this question. Just imagine for a moment. What if he's right? What if Matthew's right? What if, to quote Matthew, Jesus really is God's final king? What if it's true? What if what the angel said is true? That he came to save his people. He came to save us. He came to save people from their sin. What if it's true? And what if it's true, what is the proper response to that? I mean, what do you even do with that? And Matthew would raise his hand and say, I know the answer to that one as well. And he would look at you and he would look at me. He would say, here's what you do. You just do what I did. You just follow. You just follow. And then later, it's amazing, Matthew records Jesus' invitation to all of us normal people to follow. And here's what he said. Jesus, one afternoon, he looks at a group of people who are broken because of what they've done and broken because of what people have done to them. A group of people who were weary because of what they'd done and because of what people had done to them. And he says to them, come to me. Just move in my direction. All of you who are weary, you've tried and you've tried and you've tried and it's not working for you. All of you who are weary and burdened, the burden of sin, the burden of guilt, the burden of shame, the burden of branding, the burden of what people have said, whatever you're burdened with. And I'll give you rest. Then listen to this part. Learn from me. Sit at my feet and learn what God, your Father, is really like, because only I know. I know like no one else knows. Learn from me what to do with your shame and your guilt. Learn from me what to do with your past. Learn from me how to treat other people. Learn from me how to find purpose and meaning. Learn from me. That's what a disciple is. That's what a follower does. They sit at the feet of somebody and they say, teach me and I will do my best to follow. Just learn from me. He says, and if you do over time, look at this promise. And you'll find rest on the inside, in spite of what's going on the outside. This is the message of Christmas. Look up here. This is the invitation of your King, who came from a long line of sinners like me, four sinners like me, a long line of sinners like you, sinners like us. And I don't know how to say it any other way, but the fact that we are such bad news is why the coming of Messiah was such good news of great joy for all people. You can't get outside that circle if your life depended on it. And Matthew wants you to know that before he gets to O little town of Bethlehem. Great joy for all the people. For sinners like me. Let's pray together. Father, it's still overwhelming to me. I pray that it would always be overwhelming to me and to all of us. And Father, wherever this lands with us, would you please give us just a moment of wisdom and insight to know what to do and how to respond? But at the end of the day, would you give us the courage to throw up our hands and say, I'll just follow. I don't know where you're going to lead. I don't know what it's going to require. I don't know how to make up for the past. I don't know how to fix things at home. I don't know how to fix things with my kids. I don't know how to fix things. But if you'll lead, I'll follow. Just give us the courage to do what Matthew did that day and to get up from our table and just say, okay, I'll learn. So give us the wisdom to know what to do. Give us the courage to do it this Christmas season. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for Matthew's courage. Thank you for protecting this ancient document through all of the years when the empire that crucified Jesus tried to destroy all of this literature. And then one day the empire capitulated and declared Jesus a Lord and a King and a God. Only you could do that. So why would we resist? So show us what to do. We'll do it. We'll follow in Jesus' name. Amen.